Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Robin Abbott, CEO of the New Hampshire Society of CPAs, and Matt DiLoretto, Vice President of State Government Affairs for the Healthcare Distributor Alliance, will join the show to discuss how recent changes in tax law and COVID-19 legislation have impacted CPAs, and COVID vaccine distribution, bumps in the road, successes, and ways we are working to improve. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that with an impeachment trial now in the rearview mirror, Democrats can focus on assembling a nearly $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package they hope to pass through the budget reconciliation process. Nine House committees last week advanced pieces of the measure in mostly party-line votes as Republicans protested the size and shape of the package. Three additional committees that share jurisdiction over the aid opted to forego markups, but will submit their draft language separately for inclusion in the broader bill. The Senate, meanwhile, has opted for a more streamlined process. Committees with jurisdiction over the aid are expected to forego markups and bring a bill directly to the Senate floor. The ranking Republicans on the 12 Senate committees involved in drafting an aid package protested the decision to bypass their panels in a letter to Senate leaders last week. Using the reconciliation process, which Republicans have criticized, allows Democrats to pass an aid measure with a simple majority vote that avoids the risk of a Senate filibuster. Democrats want to pass their package well before March 14th, when expanded unemployment benefits are set to run dry. The final major piece of the House aid measure came last week when Oversight and Reform Committee advanced a $350.7 billion plan to help state and local governments. The measure advanced on a party-line vote of 23-18 after a marathon markup that underscored partisan divisions over whether to funnel additional aid to states, cities, counties, and tribal governments. Up next, Robin Abbott, CEO of the New Hampshire Society of CPAs, will join me to discuss how recent changes in tax law and COVID-19 legislation have impacted CPAs, as well as how the industry as a whole is faring during the pandemic. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Robin Abbott. Robin is the CEO of the New Hampshire Society of CPAs. She's responsible for overall management and oversight of the society, including education programs, legislative advocacy, as well as programs and initiatives designed to support its members and enhance the value of society membership and the profession. Robin previously worked for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation and Families in Transition, and she serves on the board of the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits. Welcome to Facing the Future, Robin.
Great. Thank you, Chase. It's nice to be here.
Happy to have you on the program. And I think it'd be very beneficial for our listeners if we start out kind of generically talking a little bit about what the New Hampshire Society of CPAs is, what it does, and how your role is part of all that.
Sure, that's a great place to start. Thank you. So we are a membership organization. We're a 501c6, so very, very similar to Rotaries or Chambers. We support all members of the accounting profession, including students, retirees, practicing professionals, as well as people just interested in getting into the field. A lot of people don't know this. We've been around since 1934, so a long time. And pretty much every state in the country has a society. And our main purpose is to not only help with licensing and continuing credits, because as many people may or may not know, accountants need to keep their education credits current. And it's really important, as well as statewide advocacy efforts. And that, I'm sure, as you know, Chase, has been probably one of our busiest components of our work lately.
I bet.
And it's exciting. It really is. I mean, I have to say, I came into this role very much in appreciation and respect of members of this profession. And being here now almost 5 years, that respect has grown immensely. It's just amazing what our members do and the complexity of what they are challenged with. And this year is no different.
You mentioned, sort of broadly speaking, you know, who you serve, but what's your most typical member profile? Like, who are they? Individual CPAs, large organizations?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we've largely served small firms. You know, people may not know, but about 80% of the CPA firms in New Hampshire is considered a small firm. And that's somewhere in the areas of 15 to 25 employees. That still remains the case, although there's quite a few also larger firms and middle-sized firms. And in these days, you know, we're seeing some mergers and acquisitions, which are just naturally growing firms, but that's predominantly the case. And I would say, you know, those firms, they deal much more with a lot of issues, not just a specialty, but, you know, everything from individual tax planning to business taxes to now the CARES Act and PPP and everything else that's happening. So, you know, that's predominantly been our business. And again, as I said, you know, they need to keep their credits current. We bring national speakers in, but what I'm finding is some of the best experts are right here in our backyard in New Hampshire.
Isn't that nice?
It's awesome. And you know what's great too, Chase, and you probably know this, we're such a special state in that if you have a question or you want to reach out to a legislator or an attorney, you know, we're all here to help each other. And that's a lot easier to do probably than some of the larger states like California or New York.
Yeah, it's especially true even during presidential cycles when you can go talk to the next president in someone's living room. So yeah, it's a great feature of our small state.
Yeah. So on top of that, what I want to mention and what we're seeing more of is an area of concentration around our students for two reasons. One of which is, you know, there's been a little bit of a lag in student enrollment in the profession. And what we want to make sure is we're supporting students from high school on about what the profession is. It's not just about, you know, tax filing. There's a lot of areas, whether it's you want to be a controller or you want to work an audit. And now what's happening more than ever with the, you know, increase in technology and that's becoming a component now of what this profession stands for. So you could really sort of, you know, be an expert in data analytics if you want to still be a CPA. And let me tell you, if you do that, your future is golden because there's so many opportunities.
Well, I'm a little sad to hear there's been a bit of a lag in interest from students, because one of my favorite events, as you know, I work for the Concord Coalition. We do fiscal policy issues. We do budget exercises. One of my favorite events was when we were brought in by a nationwide honor society in universities and colleges for CPAs. We had like 300 students in a conference room at different locations around the country doing our budget exercise with them. That was a lot of fun. I'd hate to think that that's dwindling at all.
Well, I think, you know, it is from a certain aspect. I think people just need more education, or students want to learn more about what does it entail. And, you know, there are other really exciting fields out there in finance and all different areas. So I think, you know, the world is the student's oyster. And at the same time, we just really want to remind them that there are a lot of elements of this profession that they can look at. It's not, you know, dad's accountant, as you may remember or not. And you know what I'm finding, there are more and more women getting into the field as known in the math and sciences area. So it's really exciting to see that. But I think overall student enrollment is a little on the low side. And I also think we as a state have been challenged with bringing those professionals back if they go out of state to college and bringing them back here. But there's some really great efforts around that. And I do find, you know, the numbers are growing.
Does the society, you mentioned efforts around attracting students to not only the state, but the industry, how is the society specifically involved in those efforts, if at all?
Yeah, we are very well connected to our academic institutions. So UNH and Southern New Hampshire University, Franklin Pierce, many colleges that offer this degree, Plymouth State. And what we offer is a couple events throughout the year. We have a career fair, which has been virtual this past year, but it was really fun, where our students can meet some of the firms that are out there and find out, you know, are they a good fit? What are they looking for? Actually meet people face-to-face, whether it's in person or these days online. We have a scholarship program at the Society, which took a huge jump this past year, where we partnered with the New Hampshire Career Academy through the New Hampshire Department of Education and offered a scholarship to a high school student looking to get in the field. And so we're really trying to do things to invigorate, you know, students and their interest, connecting them with professionals, the internships that are out there, and connecting firms with students and colleges. You know, on our board of directors, we're represented by many of these schools, and that's a great way for us to know what are the needs, what do we need to do to make sure we're present and we're promoting and we're being helpful. So I would definitely encourage students or firms that are looking to connect, look at our website or give us a call. We're pretty amenable, as you know.
And Robin, you piqued my interest earlier. You mentioned the CARES Act and PPP funding and how members of the industry have had to adapt to all of that. And you're CEO of the Society, and so you get kind of a bird's eye view of the industry. Can you maybe describe how CPAs, how firms have been impacted by COVID directly, and then what the day-to-day is like now with, you know, shifting deadlines and new legislation coming through that might impact, you know, their day job?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's certainly been on the forefront of everybody's mind starting from last year, because as we all know, when the pandemic hit, it was sort of on the tail end of tax season, which is always the busiest time for our members. And we did a lot of work with our state legislature, particularly our Department of Revenue Administration. And I really want to give them a lot of credit, because they are wonderful about connecting with us and working with us and just communicating with us, you know, because they want to hear what our members are saying and our tax providers are saying, and tax providers are able to say what their taxpayers are worried about. So there were some issues last year, as you may remember, the IRS extended their deadline. And what did that mean for state taxes? And there was sort of a, well, what's going to happen? And we were able to push it out somewhat last year, which did help, because, you know, I mean, we were dealing with shutdowns, right? Firms weren't even able to see clients. And for the majority of firms that were still dealing with clients that liked to file paper and liked to send a check, it was really challenging. So what was wonderful is the communication we've had with the DRA, with our firms, with our members. We were really able to try to streamline some of the decision making, which helped. This year, it's another situation. As I've heard from the AICPA, we're still waiting to see what the IRS is going to do just with your typical deadline, and how states may interpret that this year, whether they choose to do the same extension or not. And I'm hearing, you know, it's kind of like a 50-50 split out there, because if you push out your deadline, well, that kind of affects the budget as right. Well. It's a bit of a conundrum, but I think what we've been able to show, and we've done time and time again, even with legislative efforts, even though we don't take a position on certain efforts, that we're here to be, you know, a communication, you know, conduit, and we can sort of share that and be really open and easy to communicate with. And that's helpful.
And I do want to get to the legislative efforts that you just mentioned, but I had one more follow-up relative to the pandemic. Are you seeing any shifts in how the industry or firms are approaching the work week? You know, are you seeing firms move to a more remote setting? You mentioned limitations in face-to-face meetings and maybe going more digital. Like, are there any new trends in that direction, or has the industry sort of been shielded because it's, you know, largely made up of small firms in our state?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it ties into something you previously asked me, which I'm sorry I didn't answer, but I'm definitely seeing a shift. You know, some firms haven't even opened back up. They're not at all. They're not really meeting clients in person. And with that comes, as we've seen, this, you know, increase in use of Zoom and Microsoft Meetings and those avenues that you can meet with clients. In some ways, that's almost become better and easier. You don't have to worry about travel. You can have multiple people in meetings in the ease and convenience of their own home. What you do lose out on is that connectivity of being in an office and sort of the resource sharing and educational sharing. But I really have seen so many of our members and firms just do very well with this and, you know, learn to sort of acclimate, so to speak. And some aren't deciding to keep their offices open and just doing this. I think the writing was on the wall even before the pandemic though, Chase. And I think this has just exasperated it in the sense,
absolutely.
You know, they moved a lot quicker. You know, the one thing I do want to mention, first and foremost on everybody's mind legislatively, certainly is the CARES Act and PPP, and whether or not the tax deductibility of that or not. That's a big question, because that really affects the filing of taxes. So people right now are in the hold and wait to see, is the state going to, you know, make sure that that sort of becomes the case for state taxes.
Do you have your finger on the pulse? Do you have any predictions on where it's going to go? I didn't trap you in that one. Come on, Robin.
You know, I go back to, I'm so immensely proud of everybody that is working to do what's right and the best thing for everybody. And, you know, the people that have needed the PPP, as we all know, are businesses that were suffering. I mean, the majority of businesses, ours included, took a hit with, you know, we haven't been able to provide live educational class since last January. So we're all in this, you know, sort of place together. So I really appreciate that. That seems to be everybody's trying to do the right thing. Yeah. Right.
Well, and, you know, I'd be remiss if we didn't at least bring up politics. There was a huge shift at our state level in terms of who was in the majority, and there's been shifts at the federal level. And I'm not asking you to get political, but have there been any impacts on the industry and in our state for CPAs when a shift like that occurs?
You know, what we found, we really like from not only the state level, but the national level, when there are actual CPAs that are part of the legislature. Hmm. As you know, there's committees oftentimes, and they rely on their committee members to help them understand some of the complexities. We have lost, I believe, a small contingency of CPAs in our legislative body statewide, as well as nationally. But having said that, what we've tried to do, and we've done this a few times and it's been so well received, is you know, have a presentation or an informational session where we'll present to either the House or the Senate Ways and Means to let them know, you know, what does this look like? How does this affect taxpayers? How might that affect, you know, issues that the state is looking at? And I'm sure, as you know, their burning question is always around revenue, right? Revenue, we need money. And I completely get that. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, it's nice to be the temperature taker and at least the provider of information. And even if it's just trends, because we can't predict anything.
So are you, when you walk in the door and you're giving a presentation to Ways and Means, is it broadly looking at issues, or is it specific legislation? And if it's the latter, can you give an example of what that looks like?
Yeah, typically it starts with broader. What are some of the big issues? And BET, BPT, you know, interest and dividends, some of those traditional ones that we see. This year, there were a little bit more nuances with, you know, the out-of-state taxing of some of our remote workers.
Yeah, I heard Mass was coming after us.
Well, it's funny because, and I've talked to some of my counterparts, and they're like, so sorry, we get it. We get why you're doing us. We get it. So some of that also comes into play. And I think the wonderful thing that we try to do, at least, is make sure we make informed decisions, whether that's a society or your organization or a legislature, because that's important.
So what are the biggest issues that you see coming down the pike right now for CPAs in the state and maybe even nationwide? Like what are your antenna going up on right now?
Well, let's get through this second round of, you know, PPP and the CARES Act. And I would love to see some normalcy around getting back to some of those boring audit issues. but, you know, I think, as we all know too, and what's in the back of our mind is the year, you know, 2025, when basically there are 23 expiring provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Yeah. So there's a lot of big things there too. So that's not too far away. And what I really so admire about our members is they're already thinking this way. I've already had some requests as far as, can we get some information out there? And wow, you know, you're really thinking ahead of the curve, which is great. Because, you know, and I think I said this when I started my conversation with you, I am in such admiration of this profession, because when I worked at the Charitable Foundation, I worked primarily with attorneys, investment professionals, and CPAs. And the CPAs were the ones who were really on the cutting edge and on the, you know, basically in the forefront of the complexities of finances, the complexities of family, you know, transitions, and you name it. It just was really, it's amazing how much they deal with. And now all the changes that happen. And now you're dealing with the PPP and the CARES Act, and then you're dealing with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And there's just so much. There's so much. And I'm just amazed at how smart our members are and how willing they are to sort of be the expert in the field, so to speak.
Well, when you're talking to your members and you're looking out 3, 4, 5 years on policy issues or potential policy issues, and you mentioned the tax cuts that are scheduled to sunset, which in reality probably won't. But that's my question. Are your members operating as if they're not, like, they're going to be renewed, or are they expecting that's a hard stop?
You know, I think they're smart enough to not put a stake in the ground on anything.
I've tried so hard, Robin.
No, everything is just middle of the road. They're thinking about it, but they're not making one decision. You know, right now there's an extreme amount of focus on the current state of affairs. You know, even clients don't know what to do, and taxpayers are confused, and so much has rolled out in such a short period of time that nobody's ever dealt with before. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole new learning curve. And, you know, when you're trying to answer questions on behalf of the IRS, and the IRS isn't even really putting out there.
Well, now you just sparked a whole nother question for me. What's that relationship like for most CPAs with the IRS? I mean, I've heard that the IRS is bare bones, you know, understaffed, underfunded. I'm assuming it's more difficult this day and age to have a strong working relationship with the IRS.
You know, I think they're doing as best they can as well, without a doubt. And you hit it on the head. I think the IRS has sort of really been tackling cuts for quite a while now from previous administrations that have really kind of...
it's an easy target because the public doesn't typically like the IRS. You know what?
But having said that, they're working hard too. It's right. They're working harder with less as well. I have heard from many of our members, the challenges this year have been even bigger. The wait times, you know, we do have an office in New Hampshire that is a taxpayer sort of assistance line that you can Google and find their number. Mm-hmm. And the wait times are quite long. So it's been challenging, more challenging this year than ever. And I have to say, previous years, I've heard from the AICPA, they've really tried to promote legislature around IRS support, mm-hmm. you know, building a better infrastructure, building right. a better machine, because this issue has been coming for a while. Yeah. And it goes back to the premise of, you know, be prepared, because if something even worse happens, you want at least a solid foundation that you can then contain the fallout.
Yeah. Well, a little bit of irony for federal level policy is in our budget exercise, I'm pretty sure we still have this option in there, but the Congressional Budget Office scores a lot of policy options. And one is spending more money on the IRS to improve staffing and enforcement. And it actually results in a net gain. It brings in more revenue for the federal government, even though you're investing money basically to make money there, because they're, you know, you give them the resources, they can actually get a, you know, more of their job done.
Shocker.
Yeah, I know, right? You have the resources, you can do a better job. My goodness. Well, before we wrap up this conversation, Robin, I know you also have started a podcast. I've had the pleasure of being a guest on it. So I just want to give you a chance to share with our listeners what that podcast is and maybe shed some light on a couple guests you might have coming up.
Great. Thank you for asking that. We're really excited. We started this before the end of last year, and we've really been able to highlight a lot of great efforts. You know, the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, as you've mentioned, we have just really done a great job with sort of looking around to see not just about tax issues, but something our members want to hear. We're actually going to be interviewing an author and a professor who wrote a book regarding African-American CPAs. And we're going to be talking with her next week. Her name is Dr. Teresa Hammond. And what some people may not know, and in celebration of Black History Month, that the very first African-American CPA came from, guess what state, Chase?
I'm going with New Hampshire. Woo! For 500.
Right, you answered the Jeopardy question. So it really exciting. This is the 100th year of him being certified. He was John Cromwell was a CPA graduate of Dartmouth College. So, you know, we're really excited that we're not only interviewing people much like you, you know, professionals in our state, but also looking outside and people that we can talk to that can really connect back to how we've grown, how the profession has grown right here in New Hampshire and beyond.
This is Facing Facing the Future. You've been listening to me and Robin Abbott, CEO of the New Hampshire Society of CPAs, discuss how recent changes in tax law, COVID legislation, even broader forces impacting the CPA profession in New Hampshire and beyond. In the next segment, you'll hear from Matt DiLoretto, Vice President of State Government Affairs for the Healthcare Distributor Alliance, on the role of wholesale distributors in COVID vaccine delivery, bumps in the road, successes, and ways we're working to improve. Thanks for joining the show, Robin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Matt DiLoretto. Matt is the Vice President of State Government Affairs for the Healthcare Distributor Alliance. Matt coordinates HDA's nationwide state government affairs efforts while maintaining and developing relationships with key stakeholders, as well as state policymakers and lawmakers throughout the country. Prior to joining the HDA, he served as the Senior Director of State Government Affairs for the National Community Pharmacists Association. Before that, Matt advocated for the Pennsylvania Pharmacists Association as their Director of Government Affairs and also represented the Pennsylvania Dental Association. Welcome to Facing the Future, Matt.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Pleasure to have you on the show, and I'm really interested in what you guys do, and I'm looking forward to this conversation, and it would be helpful, I think, for our listeners to get a bit of a background on what HDA is, what it does, and the role that wholesale distributors play in the healthcare supply chain.
Yeah, great question. HDA, the Healthcare Distribution Alliance, we are the National Trade Association for primary pharmaceutical wholesale distributors. And most Americans are under the impression or believe that when they go to the pharmacy, their medications are waiting there and shipped there from a manufacturer, a drug manufacturer. When in reality, the United States supply chain operates in a manner that about 93% of pharmaceuticals nationwide are arriving at that dispensing or administration location from an HDA member, a wholesale distributor. So for example, the numbers we have are about, on average, an HDA member is purchasing product from about 1,400 worldwide manufacturers and ultimately getting those products as needed to dispensing locations, be it your pharmacy, your hospital, you know, whatever.
So what's the benefit here of having the middleman, the wholesaler, actually providing things to the end consumer versus just the manufacturer sending it directly?
Yeah. Well, there's benefit on every stage of the process. Obviously, there's a lot of logistics that go into this. We are the logistics experts of the supply chain. That's taken that burden off the manufacturer. But I think more importantly is on the provider end. You know, again, just tossing out that number 1,400. If a pharmacist, your community pharmacist out there, had to sit there all day and call hundreds, if not 1,400 manufacturers, you know, that's a job in and of itself, probably for a few people. But instead, they can call a wholesaler, have a relationship with that wholesaler. They know each and every day or every other day or once a week or whatever, that product is arriving at their pharmacy that they need to do the job that they chose to do treating patients. So we just add a great deal of efficiency to the supply chain. That's what it comes down to. Our whole business model is based on efficiency.
So walk me through the process. How long might it take? You know, and I'm sure every relationship is different, but say an order for 1,400 products goes out, how long does it take to get all that in to a particular pharmacy or location where they're selling it?
Yeah, well, our wholesale distributors, you know, obviously each one's a little different. We represent large, you know, national, international companies, Fortune 20 companies, down to smaller regional-based wholesalers. So the size of the operation is all different. But, you know, you can look at some of the larger operations. These warehouses are 200,000 square feet. So it's not just like we are ordering the product as the provider's order is coming in. But to answer your question, you know, what we usually say, generally speaking, if a provider puts in an order today, this afternoon, they're going to have it tomorrow morning, you know, for their operations the following day.
That's like better than Amazon Prime Time. I mean, that's good. All right. So how are HDA members involved with the COVID-19 response, and what kind of roles do they have?
Yep, absolutely. We've been involved since the very early days of this pandemic. I guess we're in about a year and a month in right now to this crazy new world. Wholesalers have been around in operation, responding to the pandemic since the first days. We've seen a transition though. Obviously, when early on we were, modifying our operations to respond to, we all recall, the shortages of medical supplies or pharmaceuticals to treat COVID. We are working with new manufacturers, new providers, worldwide, pop-up clinics, what have you, to keep the healthcare system functioning. And although God knows that we've hit some roadblocks and some challenges, everyone did, I'm very happy to say, the supply chain responded and absorbed the pandemic. Now we have obviously transitioned to a period of time where everything is focused on vaccine distribution. One of HDA's largest members, McKesson, is the centralized distributor for the federal government, meaning they are handling the vast majority of vaccine distribution for the country. Obviously, these vaccines come with special handling, special kitting, what have you. Our members are handling all of that. Another one of HDA's members, larger members, AmerisourceBergen, is responding by handling all COVID therapies, meaning drugs that are used to treat COVID. They are handling that. And then other HDA members are working individually with state governments on the redistribution of this product within state boundaries. So this is not a normal supply chain situation. I'll be the first to say that. The wholesalers are working with these different government entities based on the government's direction on where to get product and when.
And I'm assuming, Matt, supplies included things like PPE in the early days?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of challenges with PPE.
Well, that was where I was going. It's like that we ran out of product very quickly across the country when it came to PPE. So what was that process like? It almost seems like everyone probably went to the same manufacturer saying, we need product. So what happens in that scenario? How do you overcome it?
Well, our members work directly with worldwide manufacturers. And, I probably would forget the exact names at this time, but I remember being on the phone with some of our members who were working with new manufacturers, on PPE products or ventilators. And then, we probably all remember from the early days, other new manufacturers, maybe not new to manufacturing, but that historic, like GM, I remember was one of them, who were adapting manufacturing lines to produce needed equipment or what have you. But the one thing that our members place a priority on is confirming that the manufacturers they are dealing with, new or old, are legitimate manufacturers. Mm-hmm. I think we've probably all heard this kind of horror stories in the news of just random fly-by-night manufacturing operations saying they have, N95 masks or what have you that weren't legitimate. Yeah. That is not who our members are doing business with.
You mentioned a lot of the wholesalers working with state and local governments and federal government. It seems there have been bumps in the road in that process as well. Some states have handled things better. I'm not asking for you to name certain states, but have governments been mostly helpful, or has it been kind of contentious all along the way?
I wouldn't use the word contentious. We've been working, HDA as the National Association has worked with everyone from literally the White House task force that is charged with the new White House task force charged with overseeing vaccine distribution down to the, state level regulators that are implementing this on the front lines. And I wouldn't say contentious ever, but there's challenges still being, encountered by state and federal government entities. Some states have proven that they can get, quote, shots in arms more quickly than others. That is no secret. But the one thing I will say that seems to be the confusion nationwide at the state or federal level is the difference between supply, distribution, and administration. Those words are all kind of being used interchangeably in a lot of outlets, and there is a huge difference between them. Actually, a letter from a bunch of governors actually went to the White House today or yesterday saying that there is a great deal of confusion around how this is all playing out and that there needs to be a better job done in educating the public as to how this is all playing out. And the one thing that has been consistent through this whole process is if product is made available to us as the logistics arm of the industry, we are getting that product to the state or front lines. And what you're seeing fluctuate now nicely in a favorable manner is that, you know, the number of doses a state is getting is a lot more than the number of doses getting into arms. So, you know, there's, I wouldn't say it's a contentious relationship. I just think there's a lot of challenges and people are doing the best they can.
Yeah, no, it's like you said earlier, this is an unprecedented scenario. Everyone's figuring it out as they go along in many respects, because I don't think we were ever prepared for what was about to come and how long it's lasted and the economic fallout. Yeah. So there's a whole host of issues that we're just dealing with on the fly. And I also remember early on in this, when it came to medical supplies and ventilators, like you mentioned before, some states were accusing others of taking higher priority and getting more of what was needed than other states. And how does that distribution process, or how did it work? Is there a hierarchy of need? Is it based on order timing? Like, how do you get from manufacturer to endpoint delivery and make sure everyone's getting the supplies that they need?
Yeah, well, this is another issue that does not follow the typical healthcare supply chain response. So during this pandemic, and especially during vaccine distribution, all orders are being kind of driven by the government. The federal government is the one allocating to the states. And then in many ways, the federal government is also allocating to long-term care facilities and some other programs. But just for simplicity of explanation, the federal government is allocating product to the states, and then the states have their own individual distribution plans of saying where those products go. So unlike in a normal healthcare supply chain setting where we would just get orders from customers, contracted customers, and, you know, ship the product, this one is being totally driven by the government. So yes, in those early days, there was all those reports about, you know, certain states trying to outbid each other and everything like that. Right now, what's happening is the government is driving the product based on the supply available. So there shouldn't be any, especially with vaccine, there shouldn't be any kind of fights like that going on, because we are taking our direction directly from the government, and it's going to where they say to take it.
And I don't know how many times things like this have happened, but I remember reading a story relatively recently about a batch of vaccines. I think we're going to Maine, that happened to fall outside the window of like how cold they're supposed to be to remain viable. So that seems like a bit of a shortcoming in the delivery process. And I'm not saying it was an HDA member, but you know, what happens when something like that occurs? How do your members respond to that or rectify it?
Yeah, well, all those products, yes, that's an unfortunate incident. You know, again, there have been challenges along the way, but at the same time, you know, the temperature control mechanisms that are in with these products functioned the way they were supposed to and flagged those as being, you know, compromised. And those doses, it's I don't want to say it's a simple process, but from what I understand, I'm not an operations person, I won't claim to be, but from my conversations that I've had, those products are immediately segregated, you know, to, so they're not getting into the system, and, you know, appropriate steps are taken to see what happened and see their viability and what have you. But, you know, we are thankful that the temperature control settings are in place and mechanisms in place to flag those type of products. Even though it was a road bump along the way, you know, the appropriate protections were placed in the system to make sure that those products are flagged.
And I know I just focused on a shortfall, so I want to be fair and focus on a success story. You know, I got to evenly distribute.
Counterbalance.
Exactly. Counterbalance. So, you know, it seems to me there probably are success stories. So I'd love to hear one that comes to mind in terms of the distribution process, whether it was other medical equipment and supplies or vaccine delivery. But it also seems to me that perhaps there might be new technologies coming to market or new methods of delivery that might be produced to handle some of these. Like, you know, having like sub-zero temperature vaccine delivery seems like something that doesn't happen every day. So, you know, are there methods that have come to market that are new that your members have created to help in this process?
Our members individually, I would have to ask them if there's any, but I mean, I can tell you that this whole process has been new. And to your point, you know, our members, the ones that are involved in this process, have had to modify their existing distribution systems to absorb the complexities of these vaccines. You know, Pfizer vaccine, ultra cold, everyone's hearing ultra cold, -100 degrees, what have you. They're, you know, Pfizer is shipping many of those directly in what they call pizza boxes. It's literally a box that they call the pizza box that keeps it at that ultra cold temperature. Our members have had to invest in the ones that are handling in any manner some of these cold or ultra cold products. In special freezers that are literally kind of the size of a normal freezer, only they keep things a lot more cold than your normal freezer. You know, these things aren't going into Yeti coolers and, you know, with bags of ice on it.
I have a great visual of that now. So yeah. Thanks, Matt. Got your vaccines. Get the Yeti cooler. No, I'm just kidding.
Repeating, I did not. They are not.
They are not being delivered that way.
Our members have had to invest in, you know, special coolers to handle these products. And then many of them, when they do have to be shipped or broken down into some manner, that has to occur in special facilities, tenting and what have you, that keeps things cold. But the government has taken steps to explain how all this is supposed to happen, as well as they have provided direction to the frontline providers that when these vaccines get to your location, obviously you can't shoot a 100 degree below zero medication into the human body, but appropriate directions have been provided on how to store these products and everything, even when it gets to the front line. So everything's new. I mean, many things are new in this whole process.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned something there that I was kind of curious about. There have been stories that basically vaccine supply is kind of exceeding demand in some areas of the country right now. What happens to the excess supply? Does it stay in storage in those particular locations, or does it go back into the distribution system and go to other places?
No, it's not going, from what I understand, it's not going back into the system. And that's a big challenge right now. You might be reading about that if places do have excess supply, what is happening with it. I don't have those answers exactly. But you know, the supply, it's, again, let's not confuse supply and distribution. You know, we could all use more supply.
Yeah.
You know, because as the Biden administration has discussed, you know, they are ramping up 20% more in production, hopefully from the manufacturers. But I think where the challenge is, and it seems like it's getting better, we're lying was really on the scheduling and administration side of things. You know, nationally speaking, we have distributed 70 million products. And then I think as of yesterday, about 50 million have been administered. Mm. So that delta is starting to even out a little bit, thankfully.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we have a little bit of a ways to go. But as more providers come online, I think that's going to continue evening out.
Well, and as we wrap up this segment, you're in a bit of an advocacy role. What's your pitch? How can states like New Hampshire be more helpful or, you know, improve in areas to help in the distribution process?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the one thing that's a challenge across the board, and I know everyone's doing the best they can, is communication is always the number one thing. This is an extremely complex process. And then to also, you know, the existing system, at least I'm only speaking for distribution right now, the existing system is working well. We are getting, you know, doses to the states based on the supply available. But I would encourage states also to, if they're having challenges, to utilize the extent of the supply chain. You know, wholesalers are willing to have conversations if more can get involved and, you know, advise the states and have conversations about how to make it more efficient. And then also, I think many states are doing this already, you know, utilize the extent of the provider system too. And this is kind of an all hands on deck situation. And HDA members are happy to have those conversations if the states are encountering challenges.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to me and Matt DiLoretto, Vice President of State Government Affairs for the Healthcare Distributor Alliance, discuss the role of wholesalers in COVID-19 vaccine distribution, some bumps in the road, but also successes and ways we're working to improve. Thanks for joining the show, Matt.
Thank you very much. You all have a good day.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.